Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and in today's episode, I'm speaking with the founder of Integrated Muscle and Health, Austin Stout. Austin and I speak about how to identify stress on labs, why we should be paying attention to nutrient variety, and what to do when our goals shift. I hope you enjoy the episode, and please, if you like this show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Also, as always, if you want personalized help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we are your go-to coaches. Just hit the contact link in the show notes for more details. Now onto my conversation with Austin. Austin Stout, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My absolute pleasure. What are you excited for our listeners to learn from our conversation today?
I think that I am most excited and hopefully can be able to convey this message in terms of how these processes within coaching are kind of dynamic. And right now in our space, everything's very protocol driven and very like testing driven and things. So hopefully we can broaden horizons a little bit and understand how psychology plays into that a little bit more, and maybe help people understand a little bit more about themselves and why those things could be limiting factors for them, perhaps.
I love it. I think that that's going to be very helpful in the sense of uncovering some hidden self-sabotaging patterns, limiting beliefs, and just in general where we might be standing in our own ways when it comes to goal achievement. So very excited for that. But tell us how or what prompted you to start the business Integrated Muscle and Health.
So I had been originally I had started coaching with a couple of teams. This were way back, we had some collaborative efforts, you know, back in probably 2011, 12, that in that general vicinity with myself and a couple other coaches who, some of which are still in the scene, some aren't anymore. So, you know, we had come together as a collaborative effort, and that was probably my introduction into full-time coaching. Now, prior to that, I was doing it part-time. I was also doing some personal training in like in-person setting in the gym, working a part-time job as well. So that was starting around 2009, late 2009 was my intro into coaching, but I was also personal training in a gym, had a little bit of a little part-time job on the side. So, you know, dabbling, if you will. I would have been going into my freshman year in college at that time. So now keep in mind, 2009, full-time coaching was not really a career. virtual, that is. Like, there were people that personal training was, you know, pretty prevalent still. But full-time coaching as we know it now, there was hardly anyone doing it. And I don't know that I can even think of anyone, because the people that I know are still in the space that were around then, they also had other jobs, right? Most of them did. it was kind of like obvious thing to do, you know? So, you know, that's where I started. And then I was going to school for health sciences. So was it going to be physical therapy? Was it going to be like a nursing field? Was it going to be doctorate? What was that? Right. And then I really fell in love with this idea of coaching. And now keep in mind, again, I wasn't really making a whole lot of money back then, but at the same time, it wasn't like I really had a whole lot to lose either. Right. It's broke college kid, you know, just back then you could get an apartment for $500 a month, you know, so you just were trying to get by. So I took a chance on that and went full time with coaching probably around 11 or 12, 2012, maybe. So I had been part time for a couple years, 2 or 3 years. And it was a slow, I'll be honest, like it was a very slow climb to get to where I am now. A lot of people come in now, and it's nothing for people to make 80,000, 100,000, 120,000. Like, to get this 6 figures in coaching now is, it's not, I mean, it took years and years and years and years and years for anyone to even care about anything I was saying, let alone make any money. So, very different beginnings than we have in this space now.
Well, I love that you stayed persistent and consistent, and I have no doubt that with that also came a lot of experience, a lot of just working through doubts and failures and personal growth. So super, super cool. And I want to kind of pick apart part of your somewhat mission, I'm going to call it. So I saw that you are priding yourself or doing anything that has to do with an integrated dynamic approach to physique enhancement and health. And so, first of all, let's focus on the first word, an integrated. What exactly do you mean? I think a lot of people hear that nowadays. They're always like, oh, integrated fitness, integrated whatever. But what should people actually realize that that means?
I think that it means, I mean, if I interpret that definition as it is a, it's coaching with a wide lens. Like, it's a, it's, I'm not going to use the word holistic because that, and that suggests like holistic medicine or herbal, herbs and things, which, hey, we use that stuff too, but it's really utilizing every tool that you have available to you as a coach, right? And it's also understanding that context is key. So I may have these tools available, but they may not be useful or applicable to some people. So we don't just need to do all of the things just because you know how to do all of the things, right? It's really like if you had a client come to you and I had a I had all these tools and I opened up my tool shelf, right? And I could look in at it and I could see all these things. Which ones am I going to grab, right? Which ones am I going to grab? And which ones are most important for that client? What is the what are the big movers? What are the big levers that we can pull with people that are going to make, make a difference? Maybe because all of those things are important, right? Your movement. So again, the what I'm looking at with that word integrated or integrative is really about understanding, the tools that we have at our disposal and how they fit into the context of each situation. I think now with just the sheer amount of information that's available to us, whether it's free stuff we're looking at or you're paying someone to learn, it's really easy to get caught up to think that we need to use all the tools, right? That coaching has to be super complex, right? And there are complexities there depending on the demographics you're working with and the situations. But I also think that people get lost in the sauce a little bit with the complexity, and they probably make clients' lives unnecessarily complex in a lot of ways. And you got to understand, like, when you're dealing with a lot of us who are very type A already, the last thing we want to do is add layers to that. You're just dumping gas on that fire. We talk about stress so much, and we talk about, psychology so much. You have to be very careful with how much more you're stacking on a lot of these individuals. So,
That's awesome. No, really, really great explanation to me. It sounds like it's basically the opposite of cookie cutter, and I absolutely love it. And I think, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was a new coach, I would make the mistake of thinking more is always better. So basically, just that it often comes from a lack of personal insecurity. You want to demonstrate how much you know so that you just throw everything at the client. You're like, here is 10,000 things that could be beneficial. You do them instead of thinking about, okay, what is that person actually able to implement consistently and adhere to that, and just saying, hey, I have noticed you're not eating a single green thing in your food log. Maybe we'll start with that instead of giving them,
Right.
hey, you should do your cold plunge and here's your exact macro. Make sure you're hitting that to the T. So yeah,
Yeah.
I absolutely love
Yeah,
that.
the 25 step nighttime routine before you can even get into bed. It's like, okay, I
Precisely.
mean, yeah, I get it on paper. On paper, these things would be helpful, but it doesn't necessarily translate like that in real life. Right.
Exactly. Well, again, now let's look at the second word, dynamic approach. Again, like, could you kind of specify what that means or what a client can expect from that?
Yeah, you think of, when I think of dynamic, I think of just kind of fluidity within within the process. And that's fluidity within both coach and client. So for example, sometimes well, okay, most recently, for example, I don't know if you've seen this influx of the flu. A lot of people have been getting sick, right? It's, you know, I when I think of dynamic and I think of fluidity, I really think of just the ability to smoothly transition in and out of different things without, again, without making it too complex, without probably getting too frustrated or upset about it, or making irrational, you know, making irrational decisions when things need to change. I know you could get sick or something could happen, or you could have a bad day or a bad weekend. It's very easy to go, you know, oh my gosh, everything's on fire. What do we do? It's like, okay, nope, calm down. How do we navigate this process? But I also have to be able to do that from a coaching perspective, because I think that coaches can also feel when something goes wrong, or I'm not going to even say wrong, when something doesn't go as planned or something comes up that's unforeseen, the coaches can feel a lot of pressure. Sometimes I have to make a change. I have to do something. I have to do something radical to really, you know, keep the interest of this client or whatever it is. Or on the flip side of that, they might become defensive even. You know, they might, you might feel a little defensive when the client changes their goal, or the client isn't interested in doing something that they were interested in. You know, I work with a lot of competitors. You know, I've had people that clear up into like earning their IFBB pro status, and then they're like, well, I don't want to compete anymore. I said, okay, let's break that down. Why? Make sure this is a rational decision first. And if it is, that's fine. I'm just here to help. Like, I'm not, these are not my goals, right? My idea of what someone should be doing, I'm going to try to keep them safe. It needs to make sense. But at the end of the day, they're not my goals. Right. There, it's their goals. So there's a lot of, you know, there needs to be a lot of fluidity within the process. My clients will hear me say things like, we're going to call an audible, you know, which like that's like a, you know, a football term, I guess. But yeah, don't be afraid to make changes. Don't be afraid to scrap something and go a different direction. Don't be afraid to try things, you know. And that's kind of what that dynamic fluidity means.
Yeah, I like the differentiation between making irrational decisions out of like weight fluctuations, for instance. And a client might be like, "What's going on? Nothing is happening. Can we just change the macros?" And you're like, "Hey, listen, take a clear look at this. Have you been eating out more? Was there more stress? Have you had more sodium? Blah blah blah." The kind of thing, and making sure it's not an actual stagnation, and rather maybe going back to adherence once more. Or then on the other side, as you mentioned, especially again as a newer coach, you might be inclined to change things up a little bit too much, perhaps because you just feel like you want to keep that client interested by mucking around with the numbers too often. And then at the same time, as you said, that reminder that it is perfectly fine to change your mind, just make sure that it's truly what you want. So I like that explanation, and kind of going to the last part of the physique enhancement and health. And to me, at first, when I read that, I was like, yeah, okay, it makes perfect sense. And then my next thought was, well, sometimes those two are contradictory, I think, perhaps.
100%.
So yeah, maybe you can lay that out, how you convey that to your clients, that they're not always aligned, those two.
They're not synonyms, you know. They don't necessarily mesh all the time, but there's a time and a place for both. And you know, I can say I've never really niched down in terms of my client demographics. So I work with I mean, I work with everyone. I'd say like I can anyone that will allow me to coach them, that won't, you know, that we're not like abrasive and fighting all the time, we can work towards any goal. There's nothing wrong with having a niche, but it's just not, you know, it's just not the direction I took my business. So, you know, on any given day, I may get an update from like a pro bodybuilder who's 300 pounds, like huge person, and then a postpartum mom 5 minutes later, right? So I have to go switch, brain switch, right? Not only in what we're doing, the approach, the urgency we use in certain things, how much emphasis we put on certain things, my tone, I don't know. I mean, even just the way that I talk to people, I mean, everyone responds. Some people are pretty cut and dry. It's like, just shut up and do it. Some people respond to that. Other people definitely don't, right? So, I think that I put both of those in there because that's just, it makes sense based on the fact that I have such a large demographic. Now, with that being said, even with some of the things that are a little bit more where you have to push the envelope a little bit more, like competing, like, some of those things, the goal is never to be reckless. The goal is always to think about the, think long term, think about, because generally with health, if we think of the word, if we try to intertwine health and bodybuilding, for example, there's a lot of things that we have to do. There's aspects of it that aren't particularly healthy, but the healthier you can do it, the longer you can do it, and the better results you generally get, because if you're short-sighted, a lot of people have competed once, competed twice, and their bodies broke down into a million pieces, and they never are able to do it again. And that kind of seems silly, right? Like, that's not a, I assume that most people's goal isn't to just, YOLO, as they would say, and just go for it and then never be able to do it ever again. That would be pretty disappointing, but that happens often, right? You still have to have, you still have to, it's chess, right? It's chess, not checkers. Thinking ahead, three moves, five moves, six moves, 10 moves. While you can't predict the future, life is a wild card. Like, life is always the wild card because I don't know what's going to happen to in people's lives, and they don't either. But we can do our best in that regard.
Yeah, and I think you put that quite nicely, that we kind of want to have a baseline or a small level of both at all times. Let's say we want to keep the bodybuilder somewhat healthy or as healthy as we can, but knowing that they're probably not going to be at their healthiest, they're probably going to be peaking at their aesthetic. At least that's what it's about. And likewise, if you have someone coming to you complaining of certain health issues and they really, really want to optimize their gut health, their hormones, whatever it might be, that might mean that they're not necessarily going to be at the peak of their aesthetics if you're pursuing one or the other. So I really like that differentiation. And you mentioned stress earlier, and that kind of makes me want to shift a little bit into another area of yours that I know that you're passionate about, and that's kind of blood work. And I've often thought or also heard clients asking me, like, how do I even know, well, something is wrong aside from the fact that it's out of the ranges, but how can we like look at our labs and identify stress on there? Because I think many of the high achieving type A sort of people that you and I both work with, we sometimes don't even think we're that stressed. Like, yeah, we know we have a lot on our plate, but it's life's always been that way. So if I as a coach tell them, hey, your cortisol is probably in overdrive or something like that, they're like, no, it's fine, this is normal, I've always been that way. But yeah, how can we ourselves recognize or demonstrate to our clients as well that they are stressed through lab work?
Right. So the first thing I would say is when you're looking at stress, it's important to differentiate the idea of how much stress is in your life and then also how you perceive that, right? I mean, I have plenty of people that on paper, if you wrote down all the things that they had to do in a day or a week, it looks pretty stressful, but their perceived stress is not nearly as high as someone else who on paper has a lot less going on, right? that is a skill, that is an experience, even, if you've not had, I suppose if you've never really had that, it's going to be hard to go from, it would be hard to go from having kind of a life of leisure to owning two businesses and doing all of this stuff. Like, that would be a shock. And your level of perceived stress would be extremely high versus had you done that slowly over time, perhaps. Right. So, but perceived stress can also be a skill, right? It can be, it can be that idea of figuring out how do I respond to things a little bit more rationally and logically and evaluate them with less emotion. So maybe a different conversation, but I think it's important to point that out, right? Because a lot of people, again, they get confused. They might say, I'm not really doing that much, and there's not really anything going on that would stress me out. I said, there doesn't have to be anything going on. I have plenty of people that don't have anything going on. I mean, again, on paper, but that doesn't mean that they're not sitting there in their head all the time, right? So they're driving these psychological stress. It's like water just dripping on your forehead constantly. It's torture, you know? So, and it could be anything. I mean, people can overanalyze anything, you know? It could be just like, what am I going to have my next meal? And that's all you think. It's just, you name it, it could be stressful. So when we're looking at lab work, most people are going to gravitate towards like cortisol levels, perhaps, or maybe things like inflammatory markers or something. But there are a lot of things that we'll see manifest on labs, especially with chronic stress over time. We start to see some issues with immune function. So we'll see, perhaps like lower white blood cells. If you can get a little more nitty-gritty with that, you can look at, when we look at blood work, we have a CBC, which is our complete blood count. And then most of the labs have what they call a differential. So it would show the different types of those white blood cells. So you'll see things like neutrophils and lymphocytes and eosinophils. And you may see, commonly, you may see like low neutrophil counts, and a lot of folks that have, gut issues, you may see just overall low white blood cell counts in people. Yes, cortisol is, while it's not, it's variable. It changes a lot. So if you draw a fasted lab, you're kind of only getting, like this is your morning cortisol when you wake up. It's not nothing. I mean, it's still, if you have that number and you can match up with symptoms and match up with your life, it's still very valuable, right? None of these markers in isolation are necessarily the end all be all. Now, if they're way, way, way off the range, you pretty much know what's going on, but it's usually an accumulation of those markers, right? Blood glucose levels, like that's something we could even check with like a glucometer. We can see, wow, you're not eating a whole lot of food. You're not really overweight. Why are we having a fasting glucose of 115 all the time? Stress again, right? Waking response, poor sleep, all these things. So inflammatory markers, white blood cells, definitely cortisol. Nutrient deficiencies are another really common one that we'll see pop up. And that can be dietary. Now, granted, I would say that a lot of the common nutrient deficiencies we see outside of maybe vitamin D, which is more common, where do you live? How much sun are you getting? So on and so forth. But seeing things like B vitamin deficiencies and seeing things like magnesium deficiencies, you think, well, that's kind of odd because how would I be deficient in, vitamin B12 if I'm eating, animal proteins? And I probably get plenty within one meal of chicken or beef. Doesn't take a whole lot. Those can be gut issues, those can be absorption issues, motility issues, or things like magnesium, for example, which is pretty common, seeing like low alkaline phosphatase levels, metabolic demands of these things. If you're really high stress, certain minerals might be needed to create adrenaline, for example. So if you're kind of your sympathetic nervous system's very stimulated all the time, it's, you could think of it as these are like gas. You're using more gas all the time, so your body's kind of blowing through this stuff at a higher rate. So you might see nutrient deficiencies because of that. But normally you'll see a combination of these. You'll see a combination of the white blood cells, the cortisol, the nutrient deficiencies, the glucose, the insulin levels, triglyceride levels, all that stuff. It's not common that you're going to maybe only see one of them in isolation in a chronic stress situation. But if you have two or three things on there and the body's maybe not responding the way that you want, and you've got some symptoms in terms of how they feel, you can make a pretty educated guess that stress is a driver. at that
Yeah,
point.
there is so much there. I really like how you said that we shouldn't emphasize one elevated or lower marker too much, because I truly think that sometimes people, again, like stress themselves out too much for no reason. They might just see that, oh, that one marker is off and like, oh my God, what's happening? Like, no, let's look at the whole picture, especially when it comes also to the sex hormones. They never or almost never function in isolation. So unless we kind of can draw a correlation to other ones where one is high, one is low, or something like that, I think that's much more indicative. I think it's super interesting that you specifically also mentioned the blood sugar regulation. I think in the recent years, and also with the higher availability of things like a continuous glucose monitor or so, people are paying a bit more attention to their blood glucose level and blood sugar regulation in general. And I think that's really, really quite helpful, actually, because it can also help us uncover why we're feeling low in energy certain days. Or then for women with who are also dealing with PCOS or endometriosis, all these kind of things, how there's an interplay of all of that. And I think that's really, really quite helpful if we're looking at the entire picture. And I like that you mentioned micronutrients or nutrient deficiencies. And that brings me to something that I also saw on your content. And I believe you mentioned that nutrient and food variety is king. And I kind of wanted to dig into that a little bit, because I think, I think people are either in one camp or the other. So sort of like the bodybuilding crowd, where they're like just eating the same thing all the time. No, it's fine. You don't need a variety, blah, blah, blah. And then you often have people more in the quote unquote functional space that are like, oh, as much variety as you can possibly get. And you need to have your beans here and then your liver there and then this and that. And people get almost stressed out about, oh no, I'm only eating seven different vegetables. Am I doing something wrong type of thing? So yeah, I just wanted to take to sort of dissect that and hear why you want to encourage people that food variety is in fact quite important.
Yeah, it's you mentioned the bodybuilding crowd. They are very guilty of this, of course. It's convenience. It's also old habits never die type of thing. It's just been kind of ingrained in the minds of bodybuilders for years and years and years that these are bodybuilding foods and they're the ones that work. And I'd say that's probably true for the most part. We start to run into issues with lack of micronutrients. We start to run into issues with, in bodybuilders, especially, I'll run into when I'm running into like GI issues, for example, this whole idea of we use the term microbial diversity, which would kind of indicate how diverse your microbiome is, right? So if you think that much like micronutrients, if you're only eating the same five foods all the time, you're not really feeding a diverse array of bacteria, right? So this is something that within the research, there's still so much to learn about the gut microbiome. We know there are billions and billions of types of bacteria, but we've been able to identify a handful of them that are pretty important. We have like GI map testing and things now where we can kind of see the abundance of these things. Is it too high? Is it too low? So it's an, and the reason I emphasize it a lot is because it's such a powerful thing and it's not hard, right? It's easy. Like, again, going back, what are practical things that we can implement and do habitually, that make a huge impact because it helps with micronutrient status. It helps with microbial diversity. So it's helping the immune system. It's helping how we feel. Micronutrients are so important because I think now everyone's, not everyone, but a lot of people are so focused on sex hormones that they forget that we have to have the catalyst to all these processes, which is micronutrients, right? If we don't have the building blocks to build hormones or to initiate metabolic processes in the body, that chase berry that you take or that DEM that you take or whatever it is, they're all great supplements. I mean, they have their place, but they become far less effective, right? We have gaps in this chain, so it's hard to put that whole puzzle together without all the pieces, right? So, I think that it's important to have at least a reasonable amount of nutrient variety. Now, when you're thinking, when people get really lost in the weeds in terms of specific foods and how many types or when you eat them, even, I would argue that you're probably going to end up, like you said, you're probably going to end up doing more harm than good on the stress front when you're trying to micromanage things that much. But when I'm building a plan, for example, I may build variety right into a meal plan, or if we're using, macro tracking plans, I figure people are probably going to the grocery store once a week, twice a week, whatever it is. It's easy enough to rotate out a couple of foods, to have like a rotation of four or five, six vegetables maybe, or, and fruits. And it's not all that difficult. We have a lot of options, especially if we live in the US now. I mean, our grocery stores are, man, we have so much stuff. And I got to thinking about this, several years ago when I started to really try to emphasize it. And I thought, well, why when we were children, we would go into the grocery store with a parent. You kind of just knew that this whole section is healthy stuff, right? All this stuff is healthy. The green stuff, the red stuff, the yellow stuff, right? So why did we start kind of emphasizing these two vegetables, or these, this fruit? Like, why are we only eating blueberries, right? Why not? What's wrong with a banana or a kiwi or grapes or melons? I mean, there's so much stuff in there. So each food may have specific properties in terms of, micronutrient profiles, but the most important thing is that we're just exploring that idea of variety. And it's also more enjoyable, I would say, for a lot of people. You can do it up to the point where it becomes, again, we want to do it as much as possible, assuming it's not becoming a stressor, assuming it's not becoming an inconvenience, assuming we're still able to like prep our food efficiently, that it's not taking us 45 minutes to make every one of our meals from scratch. Like, this is some of these things you see online, like in the biohacking crowd and stuff. I'm like, I don't know. I'm not sure what you guys do for a living or how that's even possible. By the time they get done with their morning routine, we're like an hour and a half into our day and we haven't even got anything done. It's like, oh. Have you ever worked with a mom with two kids? Probably not. They
Very,
say things
very good
like,
point.
we all have the same 24 hours in our day. I said, okay. As you clearly have no concept of what most people's lives are like in terms of responsibilities. So it still has to be practical, right?
Yeah, very, very, very true. I like that you're pushing the food variety, but only to a certain point. And like you said, it's really not that hard. I mean, one food item is usually next to the other. I've heard or had a few practical tips in regards to that as well, which I thought were just amazing. So, for example, if someone does just buy the frozen blueberries, why not next time buy the frozen mixed berries instead? That automatically means you have, three, four, however many kinds that are different for your microbiome. So, same with, okay, if we can have, nowadays you can get oats or like a mixture of ancient grains or whatever, or you can get the beans, or you can get a mixture of four different kinds of beans. Like, why don't we do that? Or like the mixed veggie bags or something. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. And almost just as easy to track as well. Because it comes with a label, but yeah, I do like just the reminder of like practicality. And personally, I mean, I still eat most of the time eat the same sort of breakfast, same sort of lunch, and even afternoon snack because that's when I'm busy and I don't want to overthink like what am I gonna have different. But I try to keep my dinners more varied. Or then if someone's like, hey, I'm basically eating the same thing Monday through Friday, then just build in a bit more variety on the weekends, or maybe get yourself to try one new food item every week. Like you buy your staple groceries, but then one or two different things, like a different meat maybe once, or if you're eating out, being like, okay, I'm not going to order the same exact thing that I usually do, but I'm going to try the whatever adventurous thing is and share it with my partner. So I think even just like small strategies like that can can often really work well, or like initiate a little bit more of a open-mindedness when it comes to different food items.
100%. Yeah. You again, just try something else next time you go into the grocery store. You know,
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
you might surprise yourself. You know, you might
Yes.
surprise yourself that you like something else.
Exactly. Yeah, and to the point of gut health, and I mean, I'm totally in agreement with you that we're just really in the infancies when it comes to learning more about the gut microbiome. But what is a way that we can actually test for gut health? Because I think there are a lot of sort of schemes out there that are probably not that efficient either. Let's just say, a hair test, or then the next person has a saliva test, the next person says a stool test, and of course, stool test is probably quite reliable. But yeah, what is your go-to method that you advise?
Yeah, the stool testing's probably giving you the most information with the most accuracy, I would say, just because with the stool testing that we're using a lot of time, like I most often use the Diagnostic Solutions GI map, which is the one a lot of us use, especially here in the US. I work with some overseas people and they have some different testing available. Similar though. So the advantage to that is that we're not just looking at bacteria. We can also see other pathogens and potentially yeast and some other intestinal markers that would suggest the health of our immune system and other digestive capacity like enzymes and fat digestion and inflammation. So you're getting to see bacteria, but also overall functionality of the gut. Whereas, yeah, you can do something like a SIBO breath test, which will test, you know, hydrogen and methane gases, but that's all that it's testing. You know, it's limited, right? So it would show you what it's able to show you, but with at least with a stool test, you're able to get a lot, you know, a lot more information with relatively good accuracy. You know, food sensitivity testing wouldn't bother. It's pretty inaccurate. There's not really an accurate way to test that stuff. And also, anytime I'm getting people with a lot of food sensitivities, it's usually you have an underlying gut issue, right? It's not often that people are sensitive to 10 or 12 different foods. It's like, no, you have a problem here underlying that it's not the foods themselves, because once you fix the root of that problem, they're like, oh my gosh, I can eat, you know, insert name of food again. And they don't tend to have those problems anymore. So, yeah, stool testing probably our best bet right currently.
Yeah, and I think the good thing about gut health is really that we're getting a pretty regular feedback ourselves in terms of how our digestion is, in the sense of we're all going to the bathroom hopefully regularly, hopefully every single day, and just checking the consistency and using something like the Bristol stool chart or something like that can be quite helpful. I think the only danger with that is that we're so accustomed to our own normal. So the person that's always been constipated their whole life, they're like, oh, well, that's normal. I've always just gone to the ba bathroom 2 to 3 days. Every 2 to 3 days or so. And so, kind of moving away from, okay, that's probably still not optimal, even if it's your normal. But I want to respect your time. So, just the last few minutes,
No,
I
you're
want to jump
fine.
into the odd, what did you call it initially? The audible that someone can call. So,
Oh, calling an audible.
yes. So, shifting more into the client psychology or goal setting psychology sort of area. Therefore, like if your client says something to you in the sense of they want to change their goal completely, how do you approach an audible like that? I mean, as a coach, as you mentioned, there is a certain art with like determining what your client responds to best, or how open they even are to you trying to dig deeper. But yeah, how would you kind of go into that?
Yeah, I think that part of the coach's job is to help with realistic goal setting, because most people base their goals off of a few things. They enjoy doing something, so that would push them towards a certain goal. But also, a lot of goals are based on comparisons. You know, Weight loss goals are a perfect example of that, or visual goals, because I want to look like this. I don't know. They put up a picture of somebody from their friend or someone from Instagram or something, and it's like, well, you don't have any context on that person. You also don't know anything about them. Half the people, unfortunately, probably more than half the people that you're aspiring to look like have a lot of their own problems that you don't know about. And they may not look like that for very long. You know, they're probably going to crash and burn at some point too. And I hate to sound, you know, pessimistic about it, but that's just how it is a lot of the time. Influencers or those, it's a dime a dozen. You know, you don't know anything about those people. So, or I used to look like this when I was, years ago. And I said, well, where did that get you? Because now you have all of these issues. So think about maybe how you got to this point. Maybe that wasn't realistic, or that was actually a driver of a lot of these problems. Or I want to get into running marathons, or I want to get into doing CrossFit competitions, or I want to get into, I don't know, doing bodybuilding, you know, competitions. Like, okay, are you in a position to pursue that from a function standpoint, from a psychological standpoint? If you've done it before, what was the result of that, right? Did that go well for you? Did it not go well for you? Are you in a bad position now because of those things prior, right? Maybe it's not that those are unrealistic goals, but maybe the approach to them or the time frame that we do them in is going to be a lot different than it was before, right? So I think that managing realistic expectations with clients is a super important part of coaching, right? And they're not always the easiest conversations to have with people, but they're very important conversations. And I think that you're doing the client a disservice if you're just always giving them everything they want just because, you know, they ask for it. You should always be honest. But assuming that it's not something super deleterious or unrealistic, I tend to just kind of, I don't really make a big fuss out of things. You know, I think that I will pretty I'm pretty open to just saying, okay, what do we need to do that? Now, what I might tell them is that this new goal is going to require a lot of time or a lot of changes and things. You have to be okay with that if you're a client and that's what you want to do. Something I didn't point out earlier, but I think it's very important, is if you've been, I like to give examples. I think examples make things a little easier to understand. So let's say that you've been a competitive bodybuilder for 3 years, and you started at 20 years old, and now you're 23 years old. That's actually a pretty large percentage of your life, right? Because the first 10 years you probably don't remember, right? And the other 5 or so years you were probably just developing as a person, right? You know, AKA puberty and, you know, school and all these things. So you've really been an adult for, you've really been doing this your entire adult life. So when you start shifting goals, or you start having certain expectations or making comparisons or whatever it is, I think it's harder to comprehend bigger time frames and comprehend bigger goals when it's been such, you know, you've only been doing something for so long, if that makes sense. So I think that you should really take that into consideration when you're thinking about what you're doing. Not only that can be positive and negative. So when I say it can be negative, well, it could be something like, I want to do this, and you're kind of forgetting that you're 23, but by the time you're 30, you might want to have a family and you might have a relationship and you might have all these things. I hope you don't have regrets about some of the stuff you're doing now. You could still do it, but maybe that you could be a little more patient with it and take a little bit more intelligent approach. So when you're at childbearing, you know, financially, and you have, you know, a spouse and all these things, that you're not, you know, you hadn't shot yourself in the foot already, right? So the plus side is you're young, you know, your body's more resilient, you have a lot of time. So I would say that in either case like that, you really do need to try to think big picture about what you're doing and the decisions that you're making. Because I know I've been bodybuilding competitively since I was 18. I did my first competition at 18. My life has changed. I mean, everything about my life has changed. I'm still a bodybuilder, but the way that I do it, the way that I approach it, all of those things I consider, it's all totally different than it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So when you are making those decisions, something I'm thinking about as a coach is that idea of what life is going to potentially bring you and how that might align or not align with your goals, right? So I think that's maybe an overlooked aspect of goal setting for sure.
For sure. I love this. I love that you want the client and also yourself to be clear before you head into this journey, because we want to set the right expectations. Not that someone's at the end of their prep is like, well, I lost my cycle, and then blaming it on you as a coach. And so instead being like, hey, this is what could happen if we have to cut calories really low. You were telling me you want to get a pro card, so this is just the price. But at the same time, encouraging the client to think long term, because in the end, the goal should be for us to be active in one shape, way or form for the rest of our lives, and healthy in some shape, form for the rest of li our lives as well. So I like that, like, hey, you've been bodybuilding for, I don't know, 15 plus years possibly. So right, give yourself time. You don't need to put the pressure on yourself that by the end of next year you have a pro card or whatever. So really thinking big picture, I really like that. But yeah, I can tell you're certainly a wealth of kind of like knowledge when it comes to the client psychology as well, and digging into that. So I absolutely love that. I'm gonna make sure to drop your handles and of course the link to your company in the show notes so people can check out more of your content and learn more from you. And I'm just really grateful for your time, Austin.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a useful chat. I think it turned out well. Hopefully people like it.
I am sure they do. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Austin. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. And remember, if you want personalized help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we'd love to guide you. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening.